Welcome to Lipan Apocalypse, Episode 10, Fidelity to the Texian. I'm Brandon Seal. A southeast wind carried the sounds of gunfire up into the hill country and into the ears of the Lipanes living there. They hadn't expected to hear the cannons of San Antonio firing again so soon after the December 1835 defeat of the Mexican Centralist Army there by rebel Texians, as we typically refer to Texans, from this upcoming Republic of Texas era. But sure enough, the Mexican army had been defeated back in December, paroled, and promised to never return. The Lipanes, actually, had been the ones to try to make sure of this, sending the son of Captain Flaco, also named Flaco, to trail the defeated Mexican army all the way across the Rio Grande. But once they reached Saltillo, the defeated Mexican army stopped and turned around. They were joined there by an even larger army, led by none other than General Santa Anna, fresh off of his sack of Zacatecas. Flaco the Younger heard the gruesome details: hundreds killed, thousands imprisoned, the town looted. He rode back as fast as he could to report this to his people and to their Tejano friends. It was only 6 weeks ago. Could the cannon fire that they were hearing now from San Antonio in February 1836 be Santa Anna's army already? Could 6,000 men really have covered 300 miles from Saltillo through a foot of snow during one of the coldest winters in memory in just 6 weeks? Captain Cuelgas de Castro took a handful of trusted men and rode into San Antonio to check it out and try and link up with the hundreds of Lipanes and Lipan descendants living there. But as they approached town, they were cut off by Mexican scouts, officered by skeptical old Spanish royalist officers on the lookout for untrustworthy Lipan types to come to the aid of these rebel Texians. Cuelgas de Castro and his men hung around the outskirts of San Antonio for the next 13 days, helpless. One descendant of Cuelgas de Castro recalled what they eventually witnessed on March 6th. Quote, "We witnessed how the Mexican soldiers tossed and burned the bodies of the dead Texans into fires. We lost family at the Alamo. We buried our dead," end quote. Seeing their Tejano friends, like Jose Francisco Ruiz and a young Jose Antonio Menchaca, whose last name I hope you recognize, seeing these Tejanos taking up arms against Santa Anna's army, the Lipanes threw in their lot with them. They spent the next few months raiding the unguarded Mexican frontier in Coahuila, Nuevo León, and Tamaulipas, assisting the Texian war effort immeasurably. Listeners to this podcast will recall their effectiveness in the form of the suffering that they inflicted on the inhabitants of the Rio Grande Villas after the Battle of San Jacinto, which would become one of the principal incitements to the revolt of the Republic of the Rio Grande 2 years later. Because of the fervor with which Lipanes harassed the Mexicans during the ultimately successful campaign of 1836, they became immediate favorites of the Anglo-Texians. Texas newspapers praised Cuelgas de Castro as, quote, "a man of great courage, wonderful sagacity, and uncommon physical powers, and is also distinguished for his fidelity to the Texian," end quote. Cuelgas was President Sam Houston's guest of honor at a ball in Houston in 1838, where Cuelgas played to the crowd by crying out, quote, "Muerte a los Mexicanos," end quote, a phrase that even the English speakers in attendance could understand. And Flaco the Younger painted a particularly gallant figure in the Texas mind. 25 years old or so at the time of Texas independence, he had already taken the scalps of 8 enemies, allegedly. A Texas newspaper described him as, quote, "the pride and the flower of his tribe, and as fierce and as brave as a lion," end quote. Like many Lipanes, he was tall and walked exceedingly upright, quote, "giving an impression of bounding elasticity," end quote. He also possessed a, quote, "fierce alertness coupled with strength and agility," end quote, and on a horse was a, quote, "most splendid and graceful thing," end quote. And yet Lipanes, like Cuelgas de Castro and Flaco, must have picked up on some very troubling differences between the Anglo-American view of Native Americans and the Spanish-Mexican one that they had grown up under. The first clue was that upon adoption of the Constitution of this new Republic of Texas, the Lipanes were no longer officially citizens of any nation. Whereas the Mexican Constitution of 1824 had extended citizenship to all peoples within its borders, including Indians, the Constitution of the Republic of Texas specifically excluded them. And there was actually a somewhat interesting theoretical basis for this, namely that if you're going to be a stickler for the idea of a social contract and the principle of self-determination, you can't really force citizenship on people who aren't a part of your polity. And indeed, in the early years of the United States, the idea seems to have been that the government of the United States was the government of the consenting white people of the United States, and of 3/5 of their slaves or something who couldn't vote, but that's another issue. Indians, anyway, were theoretically excluded from the idea of U.S. sovereignty because, frankly, they had their own sovereignty. Very quickly, however, the Anglo-American Republic's concept of political sovereignty expanded into a concept of geographic sovereignty. In the 1831 Supreme Court case of the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, Indian tribes were reclassed from sovereign nations with whom the U.S. was required to treat as with any other sovereign to, quote, domestic dependent nations, end quote, that were fundamentally inferior to the overriding sovereignty of the U.S. government. This decision, of course, gave legal cover to the United States Indian Removal Acts that followed over the next half century. These nuances were largely obscured from Cuelgas de Castro and other Lipan chiefs in the first years of the Republic of Texas, however, because the first Texas president held anything but conventional views on Native Americans. Sam Houston famously had lived amongst the Cherokees for many years, and in theory had actually first come to Texas as an Indian agent for the United States. His favorable view of Native Americans would in fact long be his greatest political liability in Texas. Saying things out loud like, quote, he had never yet known a treaty made with an Indian tribe first infracted or violated by them, end quote, didn't win him any votes. And yet, the hero of San Jacinto rode to a landslide victory in the Republic of Texas's first presidential election, allowing Houston to articulate in his first inaugural address a strategy toward Texas Indians of, quote, pacification and protection, end quote. In short, he would avoid war, promote trade, and seek coexistence with them, in ways not terribly dissimilar to the previous Spanish-Mexican strategies. And yet, even Sam Houston wouldn't go so far as to invest Lipanes and other native tribes with titles to their lands. In a perverse way, the fiction of native sovereignty, as domestic dependent nations or otherwise, helped justify this somehow. Because how can one sovereign issue title to another sovereign for lands under their sovereignty? Theories aside, there was a practical, if not cynical, reason too why Anglo-Americans resisted issuing Native Americans titles to their lands. Titles to land survive changes in sovereignty, whereas if you can just push a sovereign out of their untitled lands, you get to issue new, clean titles to whoever comes next. This may have been what was behind the Texas Senate's effort in 1837 to officially classify Lipan Apaches as part of the Mexican nation, whatever that meant, so that they could avail themselves, though, of a clause in the Texas Constitution that stripped title to land from anyone who had supported the quote-unquote Mexicans in the fight of 1836. Houston was able to ignore this move by the Senate, however, and in general attempted to treat with the Lipanes as true sovereigns and as allies. Because Houston was first and foremost a pragmatist, and he appreciated the Republic of Texas's incredibly weak position. It's why he had resisted the cries of newspapers and demagogues to execute Santa Anna after San Jacinto, realizing that the Mexican general was worth much more to Texas alive than dead. Similarly, he knew that the fragile Republic of Texas needed Indian allies, particularly Indian allies with shared grievances against the Mexican Army's ex-royalist officer corps and against the Comanches. And in general, Texians perceived the Lipanes to be the toughest Indians on the block. Quote, Lipanes are more enterprising and warlike than the Comanches, who regard them with a respect in which fear is a chief ingredient, end quote. On January 8, 1838, Houston's commissioners met with Cuelgas de Castro and signed the Treaty of Live Oak Point, a treaty of, quote, peace and perpetual friendship, end quote, between Texas and the Lipanes. Notably, the Texian government committed to continuing the old Spanish-Mexican rent payments. But Texian negotiators also couldn't resist dropping in a few one-sided clauses. For example, the Lipanes promised and solemnly pledged to be and remain the perpetual friends of the Republic of Texas. The Republic of Texas, meanwhile, promised and guaranteed peace, friendship, and protection for so long as the Lipanes remained peaceable and in good faith. Also, Lipanes that broke the law would be turned over to the courts of the Republic of Texas. Texians who broke the law would also and only be dealt with in Texas courts. But there were some pretty meaningful gestures included, too, most notably of which, the Lipanes were recruited en masse into the Texas Rangers. Huelgas de Castro and both Flaco the Elder and Flaco the Younger were given officers' commissions, and Huelgas was actually given a commission as either a colonel or a general of the Texas Rangers. I can't quite tell because he gets referred to by both ranks at different times. Mirabeau Lamar succeeded Sam Houston as president in December of 1838, and in a stark change of policy, effectively declared war on the native population of Texas. Wisely, however, he accepted the Lipanes and their Tonkawa allies, considering them quote-unquote friendly Indians, and continuing Houston's cultivation of a relationship with them. Lamar, too, realized that he needed the Lipanes' help, particularly against the Comanches, who were his primary targets. On February 12, 1839, a force of 54 Texians, 40 Lipanes, and a dozen Tonkawa snuck up on a Comanche camp in modern-day Williamson County. Huelgas de Castro and his Lipanes and Tonkawas managed to sneak all the way around the Comanche camp and stampede most of the Comanche horse herd. The Anglo commander, John H. Moore, had ordered his men to dismount and tried to attack the Comanche camp on foot, showing here how Anglo-Texians were still learning the hard way how to fight on the Texas plains. The Comanches simply waited for the Texians to fire their first round, and then charged, just as Huelgas and his men were riding back around to the front. The Lipanes broke the Comanche charge, but Colonel Moore ordered his men to retreat, just as Huelgas thought that the Comanches had lost the momentum. In the confusion, the Comanches then managed to stampede the Texians' horse herd, leaving them to walk home rather undignifiedly from this so-called Battle of Brushy Creek on foot. Quote, "Old Castro was so disgusted when Colonel Moore ordered his retreat that he withdrew his command and left. Old Castro told Colonel Moore at the time that such a thing as ordering a retreat when the enemy was routed and flying had never been heard of before." End quote. Huelgas de Castro and the Lipanes managed to snag 90 Comanche horses, however, which softened the blow of the lost opportunity. But things only got hotter after the March 19, 1840 Council House Massacre in San Antonio. Texas commissioners had invited Comanche captains into San Antonio, that old neutral trading town, but the meeting quickly went off the rails and ended with the deaths of 35 Comanches, including 12 captains. Comanches would never forget that day, and would adopt a more or less permanent war footing against the Texians forever after. Which, of course, only improved the Lipanes' situation, because it made the Texians that much more dependent on them and aligned them near permanently against their old Comanche Plains rivals. So when the Comanches retaliated for the Council House Massacre with their great raid of 1840 all the way to Linville on the Gulf of Mexico, the Lipanes, and especially their Tonkawa allies, would lead the Texian counterattack. The August 1840 Battle of Plum Creek is often painted as a final Texian victory against these Comanche raiders, but to Lipanes, it looked indecisive at best and necessitated a follow-up raid. On October 23, 1840, Huelgas de Castro once again rode up the Colorado River alongside Colonel John H. Moore, the two having apparently worked out their differences after the earlier Battle of Brushy Creek. Somewhere out near modern-day Colorado City, right on the Lipan-Comanche borderline that the two had been fighting over now for a century, the Texian-Lipan force surprised several hundred Comanche families in camp and killed 128 of them, men, women, and children. Huelgas de Castro and the Lipanes also rode off with 500 Comanche horses. It was a brutal massacre, and yet it was an undeniable Lipan-Texian victory. Quote, "Great credit is due the Lipan chief Castro and his men," quote, Colonel Moore wrote afterward. Another Lipan-Texian attack the next summer would drive the Comanches almost entirely out of the Lipanes' old ranges. On July 14, 1841, Captain Jack Hayes led a force of 43 Rangers and 7 Lipanes as they approached the Frio River headwaters in the Lipanes Hill Country heartland in search of Comanches. They found the Comanches without meaning to, stumbling into a camp of about 50 men. A running fight ensued, and at one point, Jack Hayes' horse ran away with him, charging straight toward the middle of the Comanche line. Flaco, the younger, leading the Lipan contingent, had become quite close with Hayes through half a decade of service together now, and seeing his friend Hayes plunging into the Comanche lines, Flaco spurred his horse and charged in after him, his buckskin-fringed leggings flapping in the wind, silver armbands glistening in the sun, and an eagle feather flopping in his hair. As Hayes pulled up even with the Comanche line, he fired a shot to each side to buy himself some space, and Flaco came right through the same breach, firing and covering as Jack Hayes began to make a giant loop back toward the Ranger lines. Flaco finally caught up to Hayes. The two of them killed one more Comanche who got in their way and rode back to safety. After the battle, Flaco famously said of Jack Hayes that he was, quote, "bravo too much," end quote, which is cute, but it bears noting that even Hayes admitted that his charge was involuntary. Flaco had chosen to come in after him. Mirabeau Lamar's Indian Wars, though, had nearly bankrupted the Republic, which meant that increasingly, Texas Ranger expeditions were self-financed now by whatever plunder they could lay their hands on. And at a time when a man might be lucky to make $150 for a year's worth of work back in town, clipping three $50 horses from a Comanche camp actually made for a pretty good payday. And of course, it wasn't just horses. Comanches were wealthy in guns, powder, hides, and even more recognizable tools and implements and jewelry. But so too were the Lipanes. And by 1842 or so, the line of Anglo settlement had reached traditional Lipan lands. Which meant that when a frontier Anglo settlement got hit by an unidentified Indian raid, the first Indians that Anglo-Texians typically saw when they looked around were Lipanes. Rich, well-provisioned Lipanes. There was also a bias, then as now, against the idea that migratory people could be rich. Western minds are kind of schooled in this linear progression of societies from hunter-gatherers to agriculturalists to industrialists, and migratory hunter-gatherers sat at the bottom rung of this theoretical prosperity ladder. Never mind that every wealthy person that I know today who can afford it chooses a nomadic existence, following almost the exact same rhythms as the mountains-to-plains proto-Apaches that the Lipanes still imitated. But to a republic of sod-punching farmers, a bunch of wealthy wandering Indians on their frontier seemed suspicious. In 1841, Huelgas de Castro and Flaco the Elder were arrested while visiting Austin on business. Someone had accused the Lipan captains of killing an Anglo settler. It had been a Comanche raid, in fact, but as we'll see, with increasing frequency going forward, a favorite Comanche tactic was to retreat right through a Lipan camp after going on a raid. Huelgas de Castro and Flaco were quickly released and they forgave the mix-up, and Houston's return to the presidency later that year helped calm tensions too, especially when he declared Lamar's Indian Wars a failure and noted that they had cost the Republic $2.5 million. Houston would spend only $139,000 over the next 3 years on Indian affairs, mostly on gifts. And the gifts were badly needed reassurance by 1842 for allies like Huelgas de Castro and the Flacos, and they came at a time when Texians too needed allies. A foolish and failed Texian attempt to capture Santa Fe the previous year had required a response from Mexico, and on March 5, 1842, a Mexican army surprised and occupied San Antonio. The bankrupt Republic of Texas had no realistic plan to fight back. That same day, a separate column of the Mexican army picked a fight with someone who could. This other Mexican column occupied Refugio, and when a Lipan party rode into town to figure out what was going on, the Mexican column attacked them, viciously. They killed every Lipan they could reach, including Huelgas de Castro's son-in-law and nephew. It was a really strange move considering that the Mexican government had actually been quite skillfully negotiating secret alliances with East Texas Indians against the Anglo-Texians around the same time. But I think the old Spanish bias against Apaches still dominated the Mexican Army Officer Corps. Within 2 days, though, of their massacre of the Refugio Lipanes, 300 Lipan, Tonkawa, and even Mescaleros from far west Texas surrounded the Mexican column's camp. They set fire to the prairie surrounding the Mexican column and then charged in, killing 15, stampeding the Mexican horse herd, and forcing them to leave behind their dead and wounded to burn. Unsupported now on their flank, the other Mexican column abandoned San Antonio the next day. Huelgas de Castro, soon joined by 52 Lipan Rangers under the command of Flaco the Younger, who also now carried a colonel's commission, harassed the Mexican invaders all the way to the Rio Grande. Despite their heroics in defense of the Republic, and despite their success working together, Texian hostilities against the Lipanes began to increase. Most other Texas natives had removed themselves by this time far beyond the reach of the Anglo-Texians. But Lipanes, in particular, had long defined themselves by their symbiotic coexistence with European settler societies. They were still, at this time, fixtures of life within cities like San Antonio and Laredo, and even Refugio, whose bacon they had just saved precisely because they were still around. And yet, by the summer of 1842, President Sam Houston was having to issue Huelgas de Castro, the Lipan captain who had been feted at charity balls in Houston just 4 years prior, the Lipan captain who carried a commission as a colonel or general in the Texas Rangers. Houston was having to issue him a passport for safe passage between Austin and Houston. After two attacks by vigilante parties against peaceful Lipan communities in 1842, President Houston had to issue a general order to his army officers to stop any further civilian attacks on Lipanes from occurring. Then, on September 11, 1842, a Mexican army once again captured San Antonio. And once again, a second Mexican column tried to push up along the Texas Gulf Coast. And once again, now Colonel Flaco the Younger attacked the Mexican column and turned them back. As before, this weakened the Mexican army's position in San Antonio, and this time, a hastily assembled Texian force came down and defeated the Mexican army at the Battle of Salado Creek. For like the third time in his short life, it fell to Flaco the Younger to trail a defeated Mexican army back to the Rio Grande. This time, however, Flaco was joined by several hundred Texians intent on revenge. The disorganized pursuit turned into an army of conquest, with the Texians occupying Laredo, which, like New Mexico, had never actually been under Texian control, and capturing several pockets of the escaping Mexican army's horse herd. The Texians were feeling confident, and most wanted to press on further south. And so on December 19, 1842, a group of volunteers captured Guerrero, the town formerly known as Revilla, hometown to José Bernardo Gutiérrez de Lara, Antonio Zapata, and don't you just love how small of a world Texas history was in the 1840s? And yet, Colonel Flaco the Younger wasn't with this force as it pressed its luck to its untimely end in Mier, ending in the famous Black Bean episode. Because at $50 a horse, the captured Mexican horse herd represented a not insignificant source of financing for this entire expedition. And Flaco being a Lipan, and Lipanes being known far and wide as the best horseman in the state, the commanding Texian general ordered Flaco to turn back and take the captured Mexican horses back to Texas where they could be sold. And so on January 1st, 1843, the young Colonel Flaco left the Texas Expeditionary Army near Laredo and began to ride back to San Antonio. He never made it. On the next episode of Lipan Apocalypse. Thank you for listening. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco. The intro and outro music is from the White Mountain Apache Crown Dancers. You can find them on YouTube. Special thanks this season to my Lipan friends, Bernard Barcena, Lucille Contreras, Richard Gonzalez, Margot Moreno, and Gary Perez. I hope I'm doing your story justice. And make sure to check out Lucille's Texas Tribal Buffalo Project online and fill out her Texas Indigenous Data Sovereignty Study. For more information about the Lipan Apaches, check out the books by Thomas Britton, Jose Medina Gonzalez Davila, Nancy McGowan Minor, and Sherry Robinson. Also, check out the doctoral thesis of Enrique Maestas and the Texas Observer article by Dylan Bedour. Lastly, go to Gorka Alonso's website, apacheria.es. For more information on my other projects, you can go to brandonseal.com.